Welcome to the Pitt Rivers Museum's Matters of Policy podcast. This is a podcast in which we explore the museum's collections development policy, speaking with guests from across the globe to delve into the language used and consider what really matters in this policy.
Hi, I'm Yip, and today I'm speaking with Beth McDougall, who is the Families and Communities Officer in the Public Engagement Team at the Pitt Rivers Museum. Welcome, Beth. It's great to meet you.
Hi, Yip. It's lovely to meet you.
Could you say a little bit about the Public Engagement Team at the Pitt Rivers Museum and your function as the Families and Communities Officer of the museum?
I'm Beth, and I work as the Families and Communities Officer in the Public Engagement Department. The Public Engagement Department has had various names over the last 5 years that I've worked in the team. So we did start off education, then we were learning, then we were learning and participation because we wrote it on our door one day. So it was never really formal. And then we became public engagement in the last sort of 18 months or so as a team. And that has been formalized now, although it's not necessarily recognized by all teams. Lots of people refer to us as the education department still. But what public engagement does is it works with all the different audiences that come into the museum spaces. And we work mostly with formal and informal learning. So formal is secondary and primary school audiences. And then informal, which is the team that I work in, is working with families. And although communities is maybe not the right word to use now, it's that all of the community partnerships are sort of supported across the museum, but with my support as well. So I work with anyone from, I guess, under threes all the way up to older adults. I've met people in their 100th year before. So it's everybody in between. That's what I do.
Great. So you have a clear overview of who's visiting the museum and who the museum is reaching out to?
I would say maybe not 100% clear.
Okay.
Certainly, I have worked with all the different audiences that we've had coming into the museum over the sort of 5 years I've been in posts. I've met lots of different people over that time.
Because we actually want to talk a bit about the notion, the public, and how it's used within the collection development policies document.
Mm-hmm.
Because it appears 9 times in the document, as it is currently, but without a clear definition whom it refers to or who it should concern. The mission statement does discuss the sharing of knowledge amongst the widest possible public. So it does reflect the idea that the museums are for everyone and the museum wants to reach out to everybody. But our question is basically, if we would add a definition of the public to the document, how should it be defined in your view?
It's actually quite a complicated question to define the public, because for me, it's a very useful and unuseful word in both instances. Public means that you haven't had to specify. And then so it could mean it's arbitrary, it doesn't really mean anything. And so it means that you're not necessarily doing targeted or thoughtful work with the communities that, you know, surround you locally or globally. So it's problematic in that way. But I would also say it's complicated when you do start to think about who your audiences are, because when you start to specify, by its very nature, you start to label people, categorize them, do all of the things that we're trying to move away from as a museum. So when you think about the collections development policy alongside your audience development plan, then it becomes quite a tangled web of how do you think about the people that come and visit you? And is it useful to think of people as sectioned off, or do you want to think about people as an intersectional group? And what does that mean when you start to drill down into who it is that you think you're trying to reach and bring into the museum spaces, or reach by going out and spending time with them in their communities, wherever that is across the world? I think public is a very lazy definition of who you think you're trying to reach. And it's certainly something when you look at research, and particularly public engagement research, not allowed to say, I would like to reach the public, because that isn't useful. That doesn't create impact. But actually, once you think about it from the opposite point of view, which we have done quite a lot with our initial early audience development plans, then you get into all sorts of kind of complicated territory about how you define different people around, you know, what they bring into the museum space.
Great. We certainly think like it's really good to keep the notion open so it could include literally everybody and not delimit the definition of the term. We were just wondering that if we keep it as an open notion, but then we refer to peoples within the document, then the way we speak about people automatically makes that we link them to the public. So now within the document, many times British ethnographers are mentioned as opposed to artists or indigenous communities. So it seems like to automatically assume that the public is mostly British or mostly white. But like section 3 of the document mentions about 14 different colonial administrators who collected objects, but it doesn't mention any of the artists. And in that sense, we're wondering, to whom is this definition of the public geared? And is there anything within the document we can change to make sure that the notion of public is automatically associated with this wide and inclusive notion of peoples?
I think it sort of demonstrates how useful that collections development policy is when I don't really have any notion of who's in it and who's included and excluded. But from your description of it, then I think that's not useful to specify for some and to exclude for others. So by the very kind of creation of a list, then you are making an act of your decision-making in that moment, aren't you? So if you list a whole lot of white ethnographers or white collectors or whoever else it is, then you are actually actively creating exclusion. Whereas I totally take your point on, if you actually leave it as publics, then you're creating space for everyone. Although actually, are you? Because I think one of the comments you suggested was that if you don't specify, then do you just end up with the same, possibly men, because you actually haven't made any decisions? It's quite a tricky line to walk. To me, I think I would probably expand the list sensitively and understanding actually who it is that the museum has developed links with, because I think it's a bit disingenuous to say everyone within like your understanding of publics, because the museum actually cannot reach everyone at the same time. And so we need to think about, you know, where we do need to progress the relationships and the community building aspect of the work that we do, particularly when you're thinking about collections. You do need to have a sensible plan, because actually we're not able to reach all the people on the planet at one point. So we do need to plan out and understand who it is that we're building relationships with. And then over time, we can bring in new groups, but actually you just cannot reach every person in the world at the same time. It's a bit of a disingenuous statement to say publics without any kind of explanation or planning as to who you mean.
That would be a very fair acknowledgement to put in there. Try and see which voices can be included within the document to give a fairer overview of who has contributed to the museum collections.
Yeah, it's just understanding in a deep way who it is that you've been excluding, like which groups have you made no special effort for? Because I think one of the kind of challenges, certainly within my role within public engagement, is that the local communities who live around Oxford aren't necessarily represented within the collections, because the collections, from my perspective, is that they have just tumbleweeded and grown depending on like which anthropologists or colonial administrations or whoever it is that the museum has connections with at that point. I think there may have been, so I don't want to be unfair, times when there's been specific acquisitions or understanding. So particularly with the kind of contemporary collecting that's been done by some of the team, I suppose I'm thinking of Professor Laura Pierce and Professor Claire Harris, seem to have done contemporary collecting that is specific, but ultimately in terms of acquisition, my understanding is it's whoever decides to offer up materials to the museum, and that's long-standing policy. And so you get whatever is offered, and that is determined quite a lot by the connections the museum has currently, but also your ability to actually commission and bring in new works. So I think it's quite complicated that as a museum of the sort of size, and I suppose in some ways, like in certain circles, probably within the museum sector, quite well-known museum, not to actually have an acquisition budget, or up until recently have one, because actually you're only ever able to bring into the collection things that are gifted. And then that doesn't give you any ability to go, actually, there's a gap here. How can we demonstrate contemporary life? So you're slightly hamstrung by that, I guess.
Yes, that well shows the complexity surrounding contemporary collecting, because clearly there's a lot of work the museum envisions to do, like addressing these narrative gaps. But of course, the museum is also bound by the reality in which it's situated, having limited space and resources, which also poses challenges towards making its current collections accessible in the first place. I wanted to ask you if you could talk a little about accessibility of collections. On the one hand, I want to ask if you could name any barriers in relation to accessibility of the museum's collections, but also could you mention some of the areas in which the Pitt Rivers is successful in making its collections accessible? One example I have in mind there is the fact that the museum is free to the public, which already lowers the threshold to visit.
Let's start with issues and then move on to successes, and then we can think where to go from there. So one of the things that I remember often is that because I work very closely with local partners, and one of the partnerships I'm part of is the Windrush community, and so I work a lot with African and African Caribbean communities living in Oxford. we've been working together on creating opportunities to kind of highlight Windrush communities and what they have brought to the UK in the museum spaces through self-representation. And I remember my first kind of collections recce to find out what material would be in the museum that was African Caribbean. So I thought, it's not that they had to only work with African Caribbean material, but I wanted to see what did connect directly to their sort of experiences, either for those people who lived within the Caribbean or locally, to see what they could connect to. And it was very, very small collection. And it was very, I think it's fair to say that it's quite underwhelming collection of things that don't really speak to or tell you about the culture of the community without in-depth understanding of what it is that you're looking at. It doesn't speak to you directly like a lot of the objects in the museum. And I said to one of the ladies that I work really closely with, called Junie James, who runs the African Caribbean Heritage Initiative, I'm really embarrassed about this, really, because, you know, we've got this great opportunity to work together to create self-representation within the Pitt Rivers Museum of the African and African Caribbean communities in Oxford. But actually, we don't have this wealth of collections that I thought we'd have. And Junie very sensibly pointed to me, well, you know, like a lot of West African objects and things, they're actually like how our heritages have moved around. Those cultures still exist for us. You know, we may have been displaced peoples, but ultimately those things came with us. So we looked a lot at the West African collections, but it was just a moment where I recognized that as the collections have grown, it hasn't been necessarily thinking about how you might connect the collections back to people or create opportunities for those collections to speak to the people who are actually able to visit us. So it is a positive, like when you're talking around access to collections, like it is really positive that the database is online, that it is globally accessible. But actually, when we as a public engagement department are trying to create opportunities and connections with our local communities, it can be a really difficult space to be in, because actually it's like, oh, right, we haven't thought to collect any of the things that your communities have made. Like, what are we saying to those communities, basically, when we haven't collected anything? I mean, on the kind of flip side of that, actually, you know, a lot of the material has been brought into the museum in problematic ways. So maybe in some ways, it's not always great to have lots of somebody else's things in the museum. But when you're trying to kind of create opportunities for self-representation and you cannot find them, it makes me think, what does that say to the people that live in our communities about how much we value them as people, that we aren't seeing the value of representing them within the museum space? And when we are so quixotic and excited about, like, wow, yeah, we've got everything from like nearly every country in the world. Like, there's only two places in the world we haven't got something from. And then you're like, oh, right, but we've got this. Well, what does this say about this community? It's not celebratory, a lot of the objects that we have. If you, any of us looked at them, like, I think we'd have to be honest and say they weren't what we would choose to bring into the museum space to represent our communities oftentimes. So
yeah, you want to do justice to self-representation, but also fill narrative gaps within the museum.
Yeah. And it just, and that's the thing. We have lots of things from all over the world, tens of thousands of objects. But when it comes to your community, we haven't really got anything that's of interest. And actually, you know, that's a real opportunity to work with those local communities, say, like, what is missing? Where is that gap in the collection? Like, how can we commission something? Who would you commission? And that deficit at the moment can be moved into opportunity. But it's just thinking about how you work with the communities that you're trying to represent, as opposed to just being a bit like if you were going shopping, like choosing something for yourself. You want to think with people. And that's what I really like about the way that the museum has moved under the time that Lara has been imposed, is that it's so much more co-productive, it's so much more collaborative. And I feel like the collections department actually does a lot of this work now, but it's just not reflected in the policy documents.
Yeah, that's something we've noticed recently, like the curators we talk to, they're actually doing way more than what's currently listed within the policy.
Mm-hmm.
It would be great to upgrade, including all the works they've been doing over the past years, because it's just not reflected yet.
Yeah, and that's it. It's like, it's an unfair reflection of like the hard work that goes into like creating connections and working with global communities. I think one of our gaps in the way that we think about how we collect, potentially, if we were actually creating targeted collecting through the contemporary collecting that's happening now, is about thinking about who the local communities are that we want to work with, to like acknowledge that they exist within Oxfordshire. And then like bringing them into the conversation around what we collect. So I know that Birmingham Museums has done some amazing work with local communities, saying to them, like, actually, you know, like the Pakistani community is not properly represented, or the Somali community, whichever communities that live around them, let's start having a conversation. Let's include other people who aren't from those cultures, thinking what might be a good set of things to kind of share from. Let's actively commission from the communities living in the UK so that you actually see that transfer of power and money into the local communities. So it's just thinking differently about how things are collected. And I think it's so often because we think as a museum, so we've got so many things, there's no space that we can't continue to collect, like there's no display space, like we can't change the collections because we haven't got to. There's so many barriers, like so many things that get into our heads as museum professionals about what we can't do, that actually sometimes it's probably a lot more simple than we're making it. It's probably just actually having a conversation with a group to actually explain and talk through and think together. You know, it doesn't always have to result in like a massive shift or change. It can be a small thing, but it makes a massive difference to how the museum could be viewed or used by the people that live around us, as well as the global communities that are represented.
I think that also ties in with, for example, entering a restitution process, which is often seen as a loss on the side of the museum, but it's actually also a gain in terms of getting a relationship. And also, of course, it's a gain in terms of moral responsibility. But it's actually also you're starting a relationship with communities, which can be very fruitful.
You know, even when I like talk to my family or my parents, particularly around restitution and returns, they totally understand it. And, you know, my family have been very thoughtful about why returns might happen. But then sometimes it's like, well, if they want it, they can just come and get it. And it's like, well, that's not what the process is about. It's about kind of creating these spaces for new relationships based on an equity. And it doesn't even need to be equal. Sometimes I think, as in the communities that these things have come from, they should be in control. It's great that the museum gets an opportunity to be within that negotiation. But ultimately, sometimes I don't think we necessarily have that right. We might have sort of quote unquote ownership of that object legally right now, but actually some of those things we've never had right over. We should never have had right over them. You know, when we work with the Maasai communities from Tanzania and Kenya, we are really very lucky that that openness and that warmth and that fostering of collaboration, co-production is there, because actually they don't need to do that. You know, that choice of relationship building really changes the conversation around restitution and returns, because you get to know each other as people. And that changes the stories that happen in the museum, because it's not about one person's narrative anymore. It's about coming together and thinking what our shared communities, like if you think about the museum as a community space, as a community hall, if that's the principle you create from, then we're all a big community together having these ideas and conversations. We aren't the museum and the community anymore. Maybe that's a bit too, I don't know, utopian, but I think thinking about ourselves as a space for community to do things like with, by and for, then changes the way that you build things like collections, development policies.
Earlier you were mentioning about problems to enter the database collection. And I was wondering, like in these new relations, you can literally, you have the conversations with the people about how we can reduce the threshold of entering these collections, whether it's online or within the museum. And could you say a bit more about the database system?
I should note that the database is what it is, and it's having a lot of work done on it. So I'm hoping that it's going to become like epic, basically, in what it's able to achieve. But I would say, as someone that is a trained museum professional who did do collections work, I find the database almost inaccessible as an online tool. You actually need to know so much about how people organize collections to actually find what you're looking for, because some of the searches that you put in are so broad that either you get thousands of records or it's not quite the right terminology that you might have used. I think that you need to have quite a sophisticated understanding of a database, even for the online one, never mind the kind of internal database, to actually get to the objects that you're really looking for. And then what I find frustrating, and this is obviously like a, you know, it is the way that things have been collected, and it is what the people of the time, you know, the predominantly white communities who collected these things, thought was of interest to note, isn't what I would like to know about the collections that are held. So as someone who works a lot around narrative and storytelling and talking to families about the things that we look after, it's very frustrating to use the database because that narrative isn't there. And I think that's even more frustrating if you are a person that those things have belonged to, or from a community that those things have belonged to, that you actually need to work out how somebody in a museum might have written about the object that you know in one way and they think about in another way. So it almost becomes slightly obsolete having an online database. It's almost like window dressing. It's like, oh, look, like we're so accessible because we are online and not every museum does that. And it's like, yes, it is a step on the steps, but it's actually not it's another thing that feels slightly disingenuous is saying that you have online collections when actually you need a very sophisticated knowledge often to actually find what you're looking for. And when you look at databases from other collections, you get the images. So you're already creating another level of access through just being able to search through images as opposed to search through terms. You've got that additional way of recognizing the things that have come from your community, even if they might be listed under the English terminology for your thing. Like, you can suddenly start to go, oh yes, I recognize that, that's from my community. And then that starts to help build that picture for you of the things that are contained within the museum. Online databases can be a wonderful thing, but I think we shouldn't pretend that's making us accessible to people, because it's for a very small subset of people who understand how to research databases.
Yeah, I think in one of the policies within the document, it also mentions the museum as one of the best documented collections. But that idea of best documented and also documented in a specific way, as you're mentioning, already hints at some sort of systematic extraction of objects from other communities, which is not necessarily something to be proud of.
Yeah, and that's the complicated thing, isn't it? Like, I find as a museum professional, we have in effect hoarded other people's things. For who? And then when you look at some of the documentation, it's looked like the actual function or use for something has totally been lost because the person that collected it didn't think about how the community might talk about it. Like, the documentation's just not there. And also, like, you know, when you think about collections backlogs, I mean, as soon as you get into any length of backlog, then the actual texture and understanding and the stories that that object tells start to kind of fade away from it because you haven't got that first person connection. And that's where contemporary collecting is so exciting. We have an opportunity now to think really carefully about the things that come into the museum and to work really closely to commission, to sort of self-determine what stories are frame that thing that's come into the museum collection. And they have choice in whether they want to work with a museum or have their things collected. So it's just a whole different way of shifting the power within how collections are brought into museums and thinking about that sort of sense of equity as well as just having stuff in a museum.
Do you know whether it's possible to, if you know the local name of an object or the way it's known by the community, if you only know that, not the English translation, is it possible to find it in the database?
So I worked with a chap from Zimbabwe, Tabo, and we were sat at my computer and Tabo's like, well, that's the colonial name for that object. And you can see that the way that the British have done it is just like, because they're being lazy about how to say the local name, because actually they're thinking, oh, well, I can't get my tongue around that, so I'll just bodge the name in effect. And so he'd be like, well, this is actually really problematic and offensive that the way that it's recorded in the database compounds the colonial aspects of the collecting, because there's not even the right local name for this because it's been entered or written down by a white British colonial officer as opposed to a Zimbabwean speaking Shona. So he knows the names, but he wouldn't be able to search for that because it doesn't exist. And because this is why you need to have a really wide range of people that you're working with within the museum and communities that you're working with so that you actually get these things right. And so that that person who speaks Shona can type in the Shona name and find it. One of the things with the Pitt Rivers is that there is so many hundreds of peoples represented in the museum and so many hundreds of things that it's going to take a really long time to get the right names for the communities within the database as much as actually then start to have the languages represented within the database. So yeah, you would have to ask a collections specialist, but like from my working with local communities living in Oxford, we have really struggled when looking for things in the database by their local name.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I think that's why also the projects like what you were mentioning with the Maasai is so important to just get that knowledge there about the collections.
Like, one of the things around access is something that I think is specific to public engagement, is that access for whom is something that we think about a lot, because actually it's not access for the local communities that we work with very often. So it's who's able to actually access things. What does access look like? Is it like just seeing things on display? Or is that being able to be with the objects in the research space? Or is that being able to handle the object or to play the object? What is it we mean when we say making collections accessible, right? Because I don't think seeing an image on a database makes the collection accessible. Like, I don't think seeing an object on display necessarily makes things accessible. And it's where that decision-making comes in about who it is that gets to actually be with their cultural objects, which can be incredibly important. And then who is it that actually then gets to handle those things? And then who is it that actually gets to use those things performatively? What I find frustrating is that I understand the need to keep things for perpetuity, but actually, do we? What is that for? Like, why? Why do we need to keep everything forever? Like, with photographs, they're going to disappear. We'll probably only have the digital one. Sometime in the future, that digital collection is going to stop being available to us. Things are already iterative and changing. So do we actually need to worry that, you know, every single object within the collections is kept at whatever way it came into the collection? Or actually, are we doing so much more meaningful and impactful work if we actually create space for people to play lacrosse with a lacrosse stick that's come into the museum, or to have that ceremony with that thing? It's like, why do we see ourselves as the key decision makers in that? Because actually, shouldn't we be asking the communities they belong to and saying, actually, if you feel like it's the right thing to do and you've thought about it with the communities or the cultures that you are at this moment representing, then that's your decision as a community. That shouldn't be the museum's decision. So I'm very keen that we move to a position where things can be handled and performed and celebrated with.
So yeah, the object's ritual life sometimes doesn't dictate it to be permanent. Quite often its function is to be impermanent. And if we're putting it in a museum as if it were to be preserved, then we don't do justice to the ritual life. We're not really teaching people about different knowledge systems because we're just misrepresenting the object.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes it's incredibly damaging that these things are still on display in museums when they should have been allowed to go back to the earth. But it's also like, what harm is there in enabling somebody to use a lacrosse stick to do a pickup, for example, which is what Joe Horsecapture did when he came over to the museum, is that he had a moment where he could do that. When Laura Pierce used to work with Haida communities, they had to touch and they had to perform with those objects because they were so central to their knowledge systems that it was wrong to stand in the way of that. Why do we, as a museum, make a decision to stand in the way of people actually having an opportunity to be with things that come from their communities? And so it's not just where those objects should no longer exist. It's where there are things in the collections that actually need to be handled, need to be performed with, need to be used in order for them to continue to have the life that they should have done.
If we're misrepresenting an object in that way, then we're not really providing access to the object, because we're just providing access to maybe a Western interpretation of the object.
If I, like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an example, but, you know, if I guess have my coffee cup here, and it's like, right, I've got this coffee cup, but like I can handle it because I have the power in this relationship and I can probably drink coffee out of it. But if you come into my house, into my museum, like I'm not going to let you handle it and you're certainly not going to be allowed to drink coffee out of it. The power sits with me in that moment that I can make that decision. And actually, that's not great for you if you've come into my space, my home, into my community center or my museum, for me to say, oh no, I think I know better in this moment than you do about this thing, where actually you're like, oh, I thought you'd invited me in to access the things that belong to my community and I understand culturally. And what you've done, you know, you've invited me for a cup of coffee and what you've done is let me see you drink coffee. It's just like, that's a power dynamic that I just don't think should exist.
Great examples. Are there any final things you want to maybe say about successes of the museum in terms of accessibility, or more like legal barriers to changing things regarding accessibility?
I think there has been so much positive at the Pitt, and I would hesitate to say, yes, I've thought about some of the challenges today and we've discussed those. But actually, the way in which we are as a team thinking about more complicated issues for museums, it is radical, and maybe with a small R, because maybe we needed to think about it a lot earlier as a sector and a profession. But actually, like, the fact that we're taking it on, that we are confident enough in ourselves that we're actually now putting ourselves into spaces where people within our sector think that we're going wrong, that we're going too far, that we're woke, or we're this, or we're that, or we're going to send everything back, or we're going to, you know, all of this hyperbole that gets used around what we're trying to do as a museum. And we keep doing it, and we keep thinking about it, and we keep consulting and collaborating and co-producing. And in the end, I think we will be vindicated. And I'm really pleased to work somewhere that has the confidence to know that this is the right thing for us to be doing right now. And for not to be listening to the naysayers and saying, oh, actually, no, we tried that and it didn't work. And look at the this and the that we've had, you know, happen to us because of that, or the way that we talked about that, actually we stand by the kind of conversations that we're creating, and that makes it a really exciting and positive place to be. And I think, you know, collections teams are in a really like tricky place in terms of what they do, because the whole purpose of a museum often has been to keep things for perpetuity. And as soon as you start to think about who has access to museum collections and what that access actually means, then you're changing a lot of what the core purpose of museums were in the past. And so it is a really daunting space to be, but actually I think that it's very exciting what the Pitt Rivers has achieved so far. And, you know, 5 years in, it's probably the time when a lot of museum professionals will be looking for their next thing. But actually, like, I'm really excited about the long term and seeing it through and seeing what we are able to achieve together. And I think one of the things I would say is that there's a lot to learn from each of the departments that maybe has started to happen in terms of collaboration. And, you know, I think there's lots that we as public engagement teams have learned from collections. And I think there's a lot that the collections teams can learn from public engagement in thinking about how to make collections work for people rather than people work for collections. People first, collection second. And it's not because I want to be radical or like create riot or like whatever, but I actually think if you start with people, then you can have the conversations about how the collections are looked after. And actually you probably find that a lot of people are really wanting to keep things safe or looked after, but it doesn't mean it has to be in the museum space. And if it is in the museum space, then we know better what people's wishes are. And so if you think about the museum as people first, collection second, that opens up a whole new way in which you think about what the purpose of a museum is.
If you're caring for people, you're basically automatically caring for their objects.
Yeah, that is a much more succinct way of saying it. Yeah.
No, that's great. With that, shall we wrap it up?
That is cool. Oh, well, I will hopefully see you in person. Have a good evening.
Thanks so much.
That was the Pitt Rivers Museum's Matters of Policy podcast, produced by Bessie Woodhouse, Yip Borm, Megan Mann, Alexis Boria, and Bobblehat Sound. Music by Jack Fawcett. Voiceover by Dougal Lott. A special thank you to Marenka Thompson-Odlam and the Knowledge Exchange.